Hello and welcome to today's class. Today we are going to talk about some organizational issues around the management of innovation. We're going to talk about three different papers. Before we get to that, however, I just want to recap where we've gotten to so far. For the last two sessions, we've been talking about the general dynamics of technological change and how they shape industries, how opportunities are discovered. And then we talked a little bit about some of the more complex and dramatic ways that technological change can play out. And we use that to kind of challenge the rather simple way that Foster let us get away with thinking, right? So today we're going to kind of build on top of that. We're going to build on top of our understanding of how technological change happens and the kind of dramatic ways that that can happen. And then we're going to talk about three concepts which all kind of linked to the interface between organization and innovation, right? So those concepts are ambidexterity, absorptive capacity, and organizational learning. I'm going to break up this recording in four. So I'm going to break it up halfway through our discussion of ambidexterity, and then there'll also be before we move into absorptive capacity and before we move into organizational learning. So that'll be four little sessions. I'm expecting this to last a little over an hour and a half in total. So let's get going. All right. So as a prelude to today, you've read three papers. This one called Perspectives on the Productivity Dilemma. That's not a regular article, but it's actually a panel discussion between six different perspectives that are folded into one article. And that makes it a little difficult to read, and it's not a secret that that paper can give very advanced students a bit of an intellectual nosebleed, and that's fine. But we're just going to kind of move through it and the idea of ambidexterity that floats around in it. The other two papers are Cohen and Leventhal's paper on absorptive capacity, and Brown and Dugwich's paper on organizational learning and communities of practice, right? So we're going to start off with the pretty complex paper, Perspectives on the Productivity Dilemma. You will, of course, having come so far in the class, immediately recognize the Abernathy reference right there in the title. And then each of the six elements of the paper are going to provide different angles on the trade-off between innovation and efficiency, right? So for Abernathy, that trade-off is kind of a constant thing. There are going to be different balances between innovation and efficiency over time, and organizations tend to go from the innovative towards the effective, from the fluid to the specific, right? That's his perspective. So the exercise in his way of thinking is really, how do you make the transition as quickly as possible to get to scale without losing the ability to also innovate, right? It's at the point where you're specific that profit is highest, but then you kind of have this looming threat of Schumpeterian creative destruction that's going to float over the organization, right? You can kind of also think about that as with the link back to the Anderson and Tushman idea, where they're talking about eras of ferment being so essentially unpleasant for businesses and organizations, right? So you want to, ideally you want that era of ferment to end really fast so you can get into the space of more comfortable business as usual, where the profit margins are going to be higher, the competition is going to be a little less intense, and the demand for innovation on organizations is going to be lower, right? Okay, but the trade-off that Abernathy is talking about, as we discussed first class, is also what March kind of picks up when he talks about exploitation and exploration, is these mutually exclusive activities, right? You can kind of think of it for Abernathy, there's kind of this trend over time towards the specific as you're kind of phasing in more exploitation and phasing out exploration. For March, it's not so much a trend over time. It's not so much the inherent properties of the technology developing or the emergence of dominant designs that plays a role, but it's more that organizations have to prioritize between the two activities, and they can, in principle, shuttle resources back and forth, right? However, organizations do tend to trend towards the exploitative because that's where it's really most attractive to make investments, right? They're more certain. It's easier to understand. It's easier to learn. The distance in time between investment and benefit is going to be short, and the uncertainty is going to be lower, right? But you're going to have this dilemma that exploration is essential for long-term survival, but inherently not so attractive to invest in, right? In order for companies to compete in the short run, they must necessarily prioritize exploitation, right? So that's going to be the dilemma. And basically, that set of ideas is what these authors in different ways are going to be challenging as we read the present paper, Perspectives on the Productivity Dilemma. They're going to be different perspectives, as you would probably expect, right? The big idea that I want you to take away from this paper is the concept of ambidexterity. Ambidexterity in kind of the... It's a bit of a stretch to talk about the everyday use of the word. Ambidexterity isn't a very common term. But the dictionary definition of ambidexterity means the ability to write with both hands. When we use it in an innovation context, in a theoretical sense, it's to describe something specific. It describes the ability of organizations to do both exploration and exploitation, right? Kind of a way to visualize this is if you imagine that there's kind of a graph in front of you, right? On the x-axis you have the amount of exploration, and on the y-axis you have exploration, right? Exploitation, exploration on different axes. In a conventional way of thinking, you're going to have kind of there's going to be a performance frontier where you're kind of moving from fully explorative to fully exploitative, right? So there's going to be a performance frontier which represents the trade-off, essentially, the different ways that you can trade exploration off against exploitation, right? If you're below that line, right, if you're down and to the left of that line, then you're going to be essentially underperforming. You're not going to be making the optimal trade-off, right? But the idea in ambidexterity is that there is actually a space beyond that line, upwards and to the right, that some organizations are going to be able to fall into. Those organizations are going to be the ones that manage to do more of exploration or more of exploitation than their corresponding choices are going to reflect, right? So essentially the way that some of the authors in this paper are going to be arguing is that there is that space, right? That there is that space up in the upper right-hand corner that organizations can viably get to. They have different ways of thinking about getting there, but the idea is that you can get there. Others are just going to not accept that there is that performance frontier, right? They're going to challenge the idea that there is a trade-off in this form. Okay, but the question is, if we kind of say that the trade-off is there, how do you do it? Right? How do you get beyond that performance frontier? How do you get beyond the assumed optimal trade-off? Right? And the question is there are going to be different answers to how you do it, and so the question is perhaps better: what's the best way to do it? And essentially, this is going to be an empirical question, right? It's going to be a question of what does the world tell us that we can viably do here? And basically, the reason that we can challenge this, the reason that we can challenge Abernathy and March, is that it appears that there are some organizations that can manage to be both world-class innovators and world leaders in efficiency, right? The canonical example here is Toyota, who that kind of manages to at the same time be very innovative, pushing into lots of new spaces. I think that was a little more the case perhaps when this paper came out than it seems to currently be, but that's fine, right? The idea at least being that you can continuously innovate at a very high level while also being super efficient. And Toyota is, of course, kind of the poster child for high levels of efficiency through the Toyota production system and Kaizen and lean management, right? Before we go into the answers to the question of how best to move beyond the performance frontier, move beyond the trade-off, I think it's kind of worth challenging a little bit the idea that that is inherent in some of the arguments, right? So there is a sense, and this is perhaps a little bit in the weeds, right? There's a sense that Toyota, as an example, is going to be ambidextrous in the sense that it is able to do more exploration than its exploitative focus would suggest, right? But the idea here is that in order for there really to be a dissolution of the trade-off, there has to be not just the ability to do both exploration and exploitation, because March would actually say that's totally the case. What you would want is for there to be synergies, right? You want there to be a mutual reinforcement or a complementarity between your exploration and your exploitation, right? So you want, in order to transcend the trade-off, you would want to have a situation where it's not just a matter of doing both, right? Abernathy and March would be fine with the idea that organizations can actually pursue both efficiency and innovation at the same time. The question really is the degree to which the activities are mutually exclusive. And so in order for you to say that they're mutually reinforcing, you want to see some kind of synergy. You want to see innovation making efficiency better, right? So as long as exploring in one way or another is going to inhibit the amount of exploration that gets done, you can't really be talking about ambidexterity. And that, of course, is going to be methodologically very hard to see, right? It's going to be hard to have a counterfactual whether... Would Toyota be able to explore more if they compromised on their exploitation? Or conversely, would they be able to explore better if they compromised on their innovation, right? It's going to be very hard to produce that counterfactual. So the idea of whether there are synergies is going to be kind of assumed in lots of these cases, and it won't be super transparent that it's the case. So if we put that discussion aside and just look at how ambidexterity can be achieved, it's going to be helpful for you to think about some of the conceptual ways that it could be achieved before we get into the text, right? So basically, you can distinguish between sequential ambidexterity and simultaneous ambidexterity, right? Being sequentially ambidextrous means that you can switch back and forth between exploring and exploiting, right? You can do them both, but you have to do them at slightly different times, right? This is not immediately going to be in conflict with Abernathy, because his point is exactly that you can do both, but you kind of trend over time towards the exploitative, right? But when people talk about sequential ambidexterity, what they usually think of is that you can switch back and forth somewhat faster and more intentionally than what Abernathy is suggesting, right? You can kind of argue that in that case you're just oscillating between different states, and that's not really ambidexterity. But that's a little bit of a conceptual deep dive. We don't have to go there. If you want to read more about it, there's a nice paper called Being Efficiently Fickle, I think it's called, by Jackson Nickerson and Todd Sanger, which came out in Organization Science in 2002. And there's another paper from 2012 called Sailing into the Wind from the Strategic Management Journal. And what what both papers push is kind of a metaphor that you can sail up against the wind by switching back and forth between exploration and exploitation, and that you can kind of easily do that. I think it's a little bit hard to justify given what we know about organizational change. But that's, again, it's a little bit in the weeds for this particular discussion. What I want you to have in mind is that you can kind of think of ambidexterity as this sequential thing. You can oscillate back and forth between it. You can also, just as we're dealing with this, you can think about that switch is happening at different levels. You can think about the whole organization changing, that the whole organization is going to move from being fluid to specific, from being explorative to being exploitative, back and forth, as need be. That, I think, is very hard to justify. But you can also think about it as being, you can also think about it as happening at the level of teams in the organization, or individuals being able to move between operationally related efficiency and more explorative innovation. That could happen through project organizations of various kinds. And that's kind of why I see sequential ambidexterity as an empirical opportunity. But that's kind of an aside, right? The real action, so to speak, is in the simultaneous versions of ambidexterity. Being simultaneously ambidextrous means basically that you're doing exploration and exploitation at the same time, right? At the same moment in time, you're trying to move beyond the trade-off. And there are several different ways to think about that. And basically all those ways are going to deal with the way that you organize the division of labor between exploratory and exploitative activities. And once you've divided that labor up and had it happen, how do you integrate the activities back together? These different perspectives that I'll get to in a minute, they vary in their thinking about at what level you want to divide labor and where the responsibility for integration is going to be placed, right? And basically we can talk about what's called networked ambidexterity, structural ambidexterity, functional ambidexterity, and contextual ambidexterity. I'm just going to kind of run through them in headlines. Right. Okay. Contextual ambidexterity means that the integration between innovation and efficiency really can take place at the level of the individual employee in their work setting. Right. Functional ambidexterity means dividing the work of innovating and increasing efficiency between different functional departments, so that innovation, for example, is typically allocated to a dedicated R&D unit, while efficiency and streamlining kind of becomes the task of production, right? In that case, it's up to the person responsible for both departments to manage the integration, right? So you can kind of think of the CEO of a who manages both an R&D manager and a production manager, and thinking about when should the things that are developed in the R&D unit kind of move into mainstream production, and how do we manage that? That's going to be the business manager's task, right? Structural ambidexterity kind of takes a step upwards, and it's going to divide the activities between different business units within a diversified company, right? So you can think about an organization as having essentially two businesses within it. So a newspaper, for instance, might have both an online newspaper and a print newspaper. Those are going to be operated as separate businesses owned by the same newspaper company, right? In that case, integration is also going to be moving up a notch. Essentially, in this case, you're dividing exploration and exploitation between these two units. So you're going to allocate one. That would typically be some years ago, it would have been the online version of the newspaper. That's going to be the explorative one, figuring out how to work with this new business model. And you will have an exploitative model where the print newspaper is just kind of producing away and trying to optimize that. Integration is going to be a task of senior management, the kind of the management that happens beyond the two business units, right? And then finally, you're going to have networked ambidexterity, where you're basically distributing these tasks across the company's boundaries, right? You can see that sometimes when you have collaborations between companies that specialize respectively in efficient production and innovation. So for example, the collaboration between Apple and Foxconn is a really good example of networked ambidexterity, where you have Apple specializing in the innovation and the design and the exploration of new technologies, and Foxconn really focusing on efficient production, right? And that kind of allows both firms to specialize and then lets them together have this synergetic relationship between exploration and exploitation. You also see this quite a lot in the medical industry, where most of the exploration gets done by startups who, at least if they do well, get bought up by large organizations that are specialized in effectively organizing clinical testing and scaling up of production. In that case, the responsibility to integrate kind of falls at the highest level of the organization. There are versions of networked ambidexterity that kind of happen at lower levels too, that we will get to when we talk about the future of innovation management, where organizations and individual R&D departments, for instance, might be working with external collaborators. In this setup, you'll notice that we kind of move from the micro to the much more macro level of organizing. So at the micro level, there's this idea of contextual ambidexterity, that you can create particular context at the group level within organizations where you can create this synergetic relationship between exploration and exploitation. You could, in principle, get even more macro. Very recently, I've seen people starting to talk about ambidextrous individuals. I think in that case, we're kind of watering down the metaphor. At the polar opposite end, you might also start to talk about ambidexterity as a geographical thing, such that there are explorative and exploitative regions, allowing countries to be ambidextrous. But again, I think that's sort of losing sight of how the concept is meant to be used, right? Either way, you basically want to have these five different ideas in mind. Ambidexterity being either sequential or simultaneous. And if it's simultaneous, it can be either networked, structural, functional, or contextual, right? And with that in mind, what do the six contributors say in the article? The first contribution comes from Tushman and Benner. This is the same Michael Tushman that you will recognize from Tushman and Anderson. The starting point of this particular argument is a very famous and very, very highly recognized empirical study of how process standardization affects exploitative innovation and exploratory innovation, right? So notice that the authors here are not talking about innovation as opposed to efficiency. They're talking about you can have different forms of innovation. You can have this very exploratory innovation, which when they're talking about this, they're talking about disruptive innovation, essentially. They're talking about these fundamental technological discontinuities. Whereas when they're talking about exploitative innovation, they're talking about the kind of things that kind of push the... they're talking about what Christensen would call sustaining innovations. They're talking about the kind of innovations that move the S-curve forward, right? In that study that they talk about, basically they see that standardization leads to more exploitative innovation, which kind of crowds out more explorative innovation. And which is basically... March's argument, right? Part of the explanation for that phenomenon is that organizations that exploit become too tightly coupled, so there's too much alignment around variance reduction. So it's going to be difficult to accommodate the kind of variation that you need in order to have exploration. We can kind of see that as a little bit related to Henderson and Clark. It's the idea that sustained exploitation kind of sediments into the organization and makes it more hostile to explorative innovation, right? You could kind of say with Abernathy that you become specific in a particularly exploitative way, right? As kind of an addition to that, an explorative innovation, they find in that study, typically has much younger senior executives with more varied backgrounds. And so there's this idea that if you standardize a lot, you're going to retain a special kind of employee. As you move further on to the through the technology life cycle, you're going to just naturally, by attrition and by aging, you're going to have older senior executives, right? So that's just kind of an effect. And I think there's some interesting sides to that argument, that explorative organizations need to be demographically different from exploitative ones. Although I'm a little bit skeptical about trying to explain the behavior of persons or groups just solely based on immediately observable characteristics of a demographic nature. But that's a different discussion. It has a more conceptual character, and it's going to relate to that discussion between Austrian and Anglo-Saxon economic theory that we've covered earlier. Okay. Anyway, back to Tushman and Benner. The way to overcome the trade-off between exploration and exploitation for them is what they call structural ambidexterity. What you want to do in this conception is you want to divide the organization into distinct business units, each of which is internally closely coupled to either exploration or exploitation. You want them to be aligned very tightly around doing one or the other. And then you want the linkages between the explorative and the exploitative business units to be deliberately weak, right? So you want them to operate in separate ways. You'd want them to be managed in very different ways. They need to have very different purposes, very different size. They need to be physically separated. They just kind of need to be owned by the same organization. And at the head of that organization, you want a senior management team that's going to do the integration between the explorative and the exploitative things. For instance, by deciding when do we scale up exploratory innovation, when do we start to cannibalize our exploitative things. The task of creating synergies and ensuring that there are synergies between the explorative and exploitative units is also going to be a senior management task. And so that's kind of the Tushman and Benner you want to think about as the epitome in this case of structural ambidexterity, that it's an organizational design choice that's going to allow you to reconcile exploration and exploitation. Right? Organizational design is what's going to allow you to do that. Okay, with that, we're going to turn to Winter's contribution. It's worth knowing here that Winter has been kind of one of the big thinkers about the role of routines in organizations. And so it's maybe not super unexpected that his argument is going to be about how to integrate his argument about how you integrate exploration and exploitation is going to depend very much on routines. Kind of the straightforward way to think these things together would be to say that routines are going to be about exploitation and not exploration. If you want to explore, in other words, you kind of at a banal level, you want to imagine that you should have fewer routines. That would be kind of the logical way to think about it in Abernathy's terms. But instead, Winter is going to connect the idea of routines to skills And that he's going to use as a basis for saying that exploration and exploitation are each other's prerequisite. And in that way, he's going to challenge the notion of the of that there's a trade-off in the way that we usually conceptualize it, right? So he's not going to say that we need, he's not going to say, like Anderson or them, he's not going to say, like Tushman and Benner, that we need to find a solution for this. He's going to say that we're kind of misrepresenting exploration, exploitation, when we talk about there being a trade-off between them, right? So his argument is going to be that skills are the prerequisite for innovation. And so he's going to kind of riff a little bit on kind of some old-fashioned ideas that repetition and discipline and exercise and perseverance is going to be essential for something creative to occur. Now, I think that argument has, at least at the individual level, lots of good empirical things going for it. That's kind of what you see when you look into creativity research and especially the psychological versions of that. It has a lot to do with how I talk to you about writing, right? You need to practice, and you need to practice a lot before you get so good that you can really do creative things and experiment with form, right? Now, that's going to be a bit of an exaggeration, of course, but kind of the idea that beginners and untrained minds have lots of creative potential is pretty much a romance, right? It doesn't have much traction in reality. But basically, Winter's point is going to be this, right? You need routines in order for creativity. So in other words, we can kind of, at the banal level, right? And we would say you need exploitation in order to explore, right? The way I read this is that this is his attempt to restore to its proper place the idea that exploitation and innovation are in disagreement, right? The idea that exploitation doesn't involve innovation. Basically, one can talk about operational innovation. That wouldn't very much challenge March and Abernathy's ideas, by the way, but it would challenge some popular interpretations of them. The other thing and this is sometimes overlooked, right? There's some research in operations management that looks at how being involved in several types of innovation at once, simultaneous product and process development, and development of the organization can be very complementary, such that being involved in product innovation enables you to do better process innovation, right? And to have this routinized is going to be a basis for doing more of it all in a better way, right? So in this way, what Winter is doing is really kind of reappraising routines as something that is not only about being more efficient and obstructing innovation in the process, but more as thinking the two together. Exploitation in his conception is not necessarily as antithetical to exploration as we might tend to propose, right? I want to just make a little bit of a riff here on the idea that it's on the way Winter makes his argument, right? He kind of makes a leap between thinking about skills as an individual attribute to something that's organizational. And in doing that, he's kind of saying that the organization is like an individual, and talking about the conscious mind as something that top management has or does, of course, makes absolutely no sense beyond the purely metaphorical, right? And as always with metaphors, you should just avoid taking them very seriously, right? Talking about the organization as akin to a skilled human performer is also like complete nonsense, if you ask me, if you take it literally. But I think it's kind of helpful to think about how his metaphor lets us think a little better about the way that exploitation and exploration both benefit from routinization and how they might be more integrated and more complementary than March suggests. All right. Then we'll talk about the Brunner and Stats contribution. This is going to be the last argument that we make before we take a small recording break. Right. Their idea is that the way to overcome the productivity by their idea is that the way you should overcome the productivity dilemma is by introducing what they call deliberate perturbations into exploitative efficiency focused processes. Right? Perturbation basically means something like branching, or forking is what you might call it in software terms. But this idea that you kind of that you have a process going and then you create a deliberate diversion from that. And by deliberate, of course, we're just talking about something that's done intentionally to create opportunities to go in new ways. So the idea is kind of that you can jolt a very specific organization into a more innovative direction for a brief period and then move back into that specific, possibly specific in a new way kind of path. So in the short run, you're going to sacrifice a little bit of efficiency for a short period of time to do some search for alternatives. You toss, so to speak, a little bit of gravel in the machine to get the organization looking for new solutions that are not readily apparent, and that kind of disturbance might give rise to better practices, right? And the idea is quite clearly that you have managers inserting these perturbations, these disturbances into operations, and thus they are going to be the ones forcing their organizations to think differently for a while, right? So you can see this is kind of a sequential way of thinking about ambidexterity as something that you can do occasionally and then get back into efficiency mode, right? The challenge of this, of course, is that you have to have a very good sense of the process that you are disturbing and how deep to make that disturbance in order for this to work, right? I mean, it's just disturbing is obviously not going to be a particularly productive thing to do. The other challenge is, of course, that organizations don't always respond to perturbations in a particularly learning manner, right? They can either just hurry to correct the mistake and then get back on track, or they can actually use the disturbance as a reason and an occasion to learn. And of course, for Brunner and Stats, it's going to be crucial that it's the latter that happens so that you get this exploratory interpretation of what should be going on. And then basically they make an argument about how successful implementations of, for instance, lean management are precisely about involving employees in the exploratory version of being disturbed, right? That's going to cost a little bit of efficiency in the long run, but in return, you kind of get to benefit from worker experience in terms of optimizing efficiency over time. You can kind of tap into widely distributed resources. As we would think in Shane's terms, right? They're going to be widely distributed within the organization, the ability to identify opportunities for improvement. Obviously, this is not going to be, it's not obvious that this makes sense to do, right? It's an empirical question of whether it can be appropriate to involve employees in optimizing their processes and what conditions should be in place for them to be involved. It depends a lot about how you think about knowledge as distributed within the organization and who has the knowledge and the most valuable knowledge as it relates to improving productivity. Right. You should hopefully begin to have an experience that the authors aren't exactly talking about the same productivity dilemma here. The type of exploration that Tushman and Benner talk about is basically of a more radical nature, right? They think that companies should explore to jump to new technology curves, new S-curves, and that exploration is something that you have to do to survive discontinuities, right? Winter and Bruna and Stats maybe a little more accepting of thinking of innovation and thinking of exploration as just the kind of things that drive the S-curve forward, the same S-curve, right? One can't necessarily, you can kind of think about it a little bit like we talked about for general purpose technologies. And what's most important, right? Is it the jump to the new S-curve that's important, or is it all the innovation that pushes the S-curve along that's important? And in this sense, we can talk about we can think about the authors in this piece as having different points of view on whether exploration has to be very, very long-term, like changing, surviving technological change of a profound scale, or if it's just about keeping up with the S-curve, right? So you should kind of have that experience as we move into the next few texts.